From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationship with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Thanks for tuning in.
Joining us on the phone is Gail Carson. She's Assistant Professor of Environmental Studies and Director of the Buck Lab for Climate and Environment at Colby College in Maine. And she's here to talk about a study she helped as the lead author that looks into certain types of ski waxes. Now, these are ostensibly ski waxes for cross-country skiing, and there's different types of waxes that are used. Some are natural, but some are called fluoro-type ski waxes, and we're here to talk about a study they did that looked into some of the chemical compounds that are within these fluoro-type ski waxes and what happens to them when they're introduced to the environment. Professor Carlson, thanks so much for joining Nell and myself this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, let's start here. Let's get a little definition of terms out of the way, because we call these chemicals PFOSs, and sometimes they're related to another type of chemicals, PFOAs. PFOSs, P-F-A-S. What does that stand for?
Yeah, so PFAS or PFAS chemicals is an abbreviation that stands for per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. So that's a chemical mouthful. What PFAS are it's actually a family of a large number of chemicals that include PFOA, PFOA, like you mentioned, and thousands of other chemicals that are used in a number of products that we're familiar with. We're talking about ski wax today, but also things like water, stain, and grease-resistant treatments and coatings in pans and carpets and jackets, things like that.
Okay. And what benefit do they provide in those situations?
Right. So PFAS chemicals were developed to be very high-performance coatings and treatments to prevent your eggs from sticking to your pan. Mm-hmm. If you have a Teflon pan or other form of nonstick pan that has a fluoro coating, your Gore-Tex jacket to, keep it waterproof, to keep your furniture or carpets stain resistant. So PFAS chemicals have properties that make them confer these resistant properties to products. But those same properties that make them desirable from a performance standpoint actually make them very bad for the environment.
Hmm. So let's talk a little bit more about that. We have, we've talked about these PFOSs and PFOAs on the show before. And we know that some of these chemicals are known to have harmful health impacts, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So a couple of the PFAS chemicals that have been used at the highest levels for the longest time are PFOA and PFOS. Mm. And I gather you had Rob Bellott on your show, and you mm-hmm. were talking about DuPont and PFOA.
Right.
That is the precursor chemical that makes Teflon. PFOS has been manufactured by 3M in Minnesota and used to make things like Scotch Guard and firefighting foam. And we know a fair bit about those two chemicals, and those are just two of the more than 4,000 PFAS that are out there in various forms of use. What we know about many of them is that they are what is referred to as PBTs, persistent, bioaccumulative, and toxic chemicals. So persistent means that they don't break down readily in the environment or in the human body, which is a desirable trait if you want a long-lasting, stain-resistant or water-resistant coating on a product, but it's not desirable if they're hazardous and they don't break down in the environment, which is what we have. They're bioaccumulative, which means that they build up in the human body and they can build up in animals, wildlife, and plants. And then they have toxic properties. And we know the most about about the toxic properties of PFOA and PFOS because there are populations in the United States that have been highly exposed, either because they were industrial workers or because their drinking water was highly contaminated. And so we know that the exposure to these chemicals is linked to several forms of cancer, ulcerative colitis, high cholesterol, thyroid problems, birth defects, and some other health problems.
And these are chemicals that have been around for decades, correct?
Yes, they were first manufactured in the early 1950s, and they've been manufactured constantly since then. They were first put in ski waxes in about the 1980s.
Okay. All right, and we'll get to that in a minute, because I still have a couple questions just about the nature of this chemical, because this is a bad combination. I'll say the fact that it's both persistent, meaning like you say, that it does not break down like, say, some types of gasoline or diesel. If you spill that on the ground over time, those chemicals break down into less toxic forms, or the soil or the bacteria in the soil help break down those chemicals. This doesn't happen with PFOAs and PFOSs. And it's bioaccumulative, which we know, for example, like DDT is an example of a famous type of bioaccumulative compound that just builds and builds up inside ourselves and inside plants or animals, et cetera, fish, all kinds of things. That's a bad combination.
Yes, it is. And there are several classes of chemicals that are particularly problematic, like the PFAS chemicals. And you bring up DDT, which is an example of an organochlorine. Some of your listeners may be familiar with chemicals like PCBs or dioxins, which are sort of well-known long-term environmental contaminants. And they are chlorinated chemicals. The PFAS are fluorinated chemicals. They all have carbon fluorine bonds. And all of these so-called halogenated classes of compounds are PBTs. They are long-lasting contaminants in the environment. And, they really are not subject to some of the breakdown pathways that you mentioned, like photodegradation in the light, or breakdown in water, or breakdown by microbes. In fact, again, the 3M and DuPont people who were making these chemicals, there are some internal documents where they basically say these things do not break down. Again, great from a performance standpoint, terrible from an environmental contamination standpoint. That's where PFAS got their moniker, forever chemicals. Once they're out in the environment, it's extremely difficult to remediate them. They persist, in air, water, and soil, and in drinking water, and in our food supply, and it's really a mess.
So with all of that in mind, I can imagine our listeners are wondering,
I've changed the channel.
Yeah, that's right.
As usual.
This is too much.
We're too early. This is, okay, go ahead.
How do chemicals like these come to be so incredibly widely used without being, known to be safe, right? How does
that
happen?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it points to, really a fatal flaw in our environmental regulatory, our chemical regulatory system in the United States in particular. But when these chemicals were first being developed after World War II, we didn't have a chemicals policy. We didn't have a law that governed, the manufacture, import, sale, use of chemicals. And, no one was really asking industry to do any form of meaningful safety testing before chemicals were synthesized in the laboratory and produced and used. In the mid-70s, Congress passed our chemicals law, which is called the Toxic Substances Control Act, or TSCA, it's abbreviated. And what that law did was to create just a very minimal bare bones chemical regulatory system. It's not particularly, has not been particularly effective. But one of the problems is it grandfathered in all chemicals that were already being made and used in our economy. So all of the PFAS chemicals and, you know, other types of chemicals like that just basically got a free pass. So, you know, they're never, and the burden is entirely on the EPA and the public to, you know, meet some statutory requirements to, in order to require testing, safety testing for some of these chemicals. So we really have not had safety testing for most PFAS chemicals this whole time. And, you know, a couple of them have been voluntarily phased out in the United States, PFOA and PFOS, which is good, but there are, you know, thousands of others that we need to think about.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Gail Carson. She's the Assistant Professor of Environmental Studies and the Director of the Buck Lab for Climate and Environment at Colby College in Maine. And we're talking about these forever chemicals, PFOAs and PFOSs, et cetera, that are in the environment. And now we can turn our attention to the study that you performed looking at the presence of these chemicals in ski wax. So talk a little bit about the motivation behind this study and what it considered.
Yeah, so this study, I was interested in doing this study looking at how the use of fluorinated ski waxes contaminated the environment at a local ski area. I was interested in doing this because, you know, my work focuses on, you know, chemical pollution and the human health impacts. And also, my son actually became a competitive Nordic skier in junior high and high school. And, you know, I got to see firsthand what kinds of waxes were being used and how waxing was being done. And I was very concerned about his health and actually made him come home and use non-fluoro waxes and wax his own skis, not with the team. So I had a student in the environmental studies program here at Colby, who is had been a member of the Nordic ski team. She just graduated, and she wanted to do this study. She said, "Why don't we, you know, let's look at this." So we went out to our local Nordic ski place, which is really a fantastic, you know, facility with you know, over 10 kilometers of groomed trails, and it's beautiful and it's well maintained, and it's a place where lots of people recreate, and also there are competitive ski races. And we went out there on a day that our Colby College hosted a ski race, and we collected snow and groundwater and runoff water right after the race so that we could determine if there were any fluorinated chemicals in those environmental samples. And we sent them off to a lab in Massachusetts, and they actually did the testing. And then we ended up going out later after the snow melted and the ground softened to collect some soil samples as well, so that we have a preliminary look at how these chemicals contaminate the environment.
Well, I have to say, as somebody that grew up Nordic ski racing, this topic hit really close to home, both with the waxing and also wondering about the impacts on, you know, the snow and the water quality in the ground. We're talking about this specifically in relation to Nordic skiing. Does this relate to downhill skiing as well when we think about the waxes that are being used?
Yes. So the waxes that are used for downhill skiing and snowboarding are very similar to the waxes that are used in Nordic skiing. Mm. There are many different types of waxes. Some of them are contain fluorinated chemicals. Some of them do not. And not to get ahead of the story, but there are some changes coming. So
good.
We're hoping there'll be much more use of fluoro-free waxes soon. But and then there are some differences in terms of how the waxes are used for downhill versus Nordic and how often they're used. But the same types of waxes are used, and then so then the same sort of types of phenomena where the waxes rub off or abrade onto the snow and, you know, enter the environment and persist in, you know, snow, soil, water, those same things can happen. What's interesting is there were very few studies looking at this phenomenon before mine. There were a few in Norway and Sweden as long ago as a decade ago. So I was also really interested in looking to see if there were if it was the same or if it was different, but I haven't seen studies of downhill ski areas. Now, of course, it's a hill and the snow is going to run off down the hill. One would expect similar types of environmental contamination.
Right.
Okay.
But real quick, I'm assuming that the samples of snow that you collected were probably in areas of high traffic around the starting areas.
So the way we designed our study is we collected, so you may know when you have a Nordic ski race, this was a freestyle race, and we were assured by the coaches that fluoro waxes were being used.
Yeah.
And it was a single start, everybody had a start time. So everyone was lined up in the stadium in kind of single file. And so it was very easy to identify where these newly waxed skis were touching the snow. So we collected snow samples right there at the start line, and then we collected snow samples at an easily accessible point on the race course that ended up being 3.9 kilometers into the race, and then we collected snow off the course as well, so that we could see, we figured that the high traffic area snow would be the samples that would have the most contamination if it was occurring. And that is indeed what we saw. We saw extraordinarily high levels of numerous, over a dozen fluorinated chemicals in the snow at the start line, indicating that these chemicals were rubbing off onto the snow, right away as skiers waited for their start time or as they took off to start the race.
Right.
And then there was much less contamination 3.9 kilometers into the race course, although
right.
still detectable levels of the PFAS chemicals that we know are components of these ski waxes.
And when you say detectable, what kind of concentrations are we talking about? What was the range of concentrations?
Yeah, so the range is many orders of magnitude depending upon the samples, but the highest levels that we found, which were among the highest levels ever found in a non-soil sample, by this testing lab, they flagged it as, wow, what is going on with these long chain PFAS that are really, really highly contaminating the soil or the snow at the start line. These were in the low part per billion range. That's a high amount. And then in the, going down to the low part per trillion range, again, depending upon the chemical and where along the race course, we were testing. And part per billion might sound like, oh, that's not too much. But it actually is, because these things are so extraordinarily persistent and toxic. And the few sort of standards that we have for limits to environmental contamination are in the parts per trillion range. So this is actually a high level of contamination.
So how did this then impact the samples that you took once the snow had melted and you were looking at the soil and the groundwater?
Yes. So there's shallow groundwater out there that we were able to collect at the same time as the snow, because it's non-potable, but it comes out of a tap in a sink in a maintenance shed. That actually had, pretty significant levels of 7 different PFAS chemicals, and they were all the short chain chemicals. There are short chain and long chain PFAS that we looked for, and the long chain ones are the ones that are highly enriched in ski waxes, but the ski waxes also contain short chain. The interesting thing is the short chain chemicals will run off more readily when snow melts, and they move much more quickly through water, through soil, and that's what we saw in the shallow groundwater out there. The longer chain chemicals we didn't see in the groundwater, but we did detect them in the soil, especially the soil at the start area that was basically right underneath that snow that had been so heavily contaminated. And the type, the individual chemicals that we found are consistent with the profile of ski wax chemicals. So we think that it's not some sort of background contamination, but it actually derived from the ski wax use.
That's a good point. I mean, you're assuming that this is coming from ski wax. Might there be other sources of these compounds? Again, you mentioned clothing.
Absolutely.
So they could play a role in this.
Yes. And actually, when you do PFAS environmental testing, you get a long list of products and clothing that you're not supposed to wear so that you don't contaminate your samples. And so that would include anything that has, you know, Gore-Tex or other sort of DWR, you know, waterproof coating in your high performance outer gear, or, you know, Scotch guarded boots, or, you know, Gore-Tex boots. But we weren't even supposed to bring out, you know, recycled paper towels and Post-it notes and fat Sharpie pens and aluminum foil, things that you're like, wait a minute, I didn't know there were PFAS chemicals in these things. So just really quickly, it could come from the use of something that contains a PFAS coating, like waterproof boots or jackets. In Maine, there's been a practice of taking PFAS contaminated sewage sludge, not knowing that it was PFAS contaminated, right, and spreading it on the land. So we have a lot of soil contamination. We've had some dairy farms that have been contaminated. And then there also are global sources, because we manufacture, use, produce, and dispose of these things everywhere, and they can get into water and into the air and be long-range contaminants. So, and it's difficult to sort of, you know, determine, okay, which sources are in any one location? Are they more local or are they more global? Fortunately for our study, we could see kind of the fingerprint of ski wax, so we could determine that ski wax use was the likely source of contamination out at this particular site. Mm.
It is kind of a stunning array of products and chemicals that you mentioned, just in that quick list of things that you weren't allowed to wear or use. But kind of focusing back to the ski wax, so you have done this research, you found this contamination, and then you mentioned that there are some changes kind of coming down the pipeline here as far as formulation of our ski waxes?
Absolutely. So changes are coming fast for the upcoming ski season. There are many restrictions on the use of floral waxes, which I think is really going to have a huge impact for the better. So the International Ski Federation has restricted them in competitions. U.S. Ski and Snowboard has, and collegiate racing. Here in Maine, the Maine Principals Association is restricting it for high school races. The New England Nordic Ski Association, NENSA, is restricting it. So I think we're really seeing, the competitive use of floral waxes, go away here, which is going to be, really great. We're still going to have to deal with the existing and legacy contamination problems, but it will be really important to not be introducing, you know, additional chemicals, PFAS chemicals into the environment from ski wax use. And then on the manufacturer side, ski wax manufacturers are still making fluoro products. You can just go to their websites and see. They do have to change the formulations because of some chemical restrictions that have happened in Europe and through an international treaty. But you're also seeing more and more fluoro-free products, and I think that's probably where we're going to have to go as the fluoro ski waxes aren't being used in competitions. And so there's a whole number of fluoro-free products that are coming, including some. There's a company that a Colby graduate started called Mountain Flow Eco Wax. We had an email exchange after my paper came out, and he's working on a plant-based wax. So the nice thing about restrictions and policy changes is that it forces innovation in manufacture. So I'm hoping that, this will be a tipping point.
Well, it's always good news to hear when these changes are taking place. But I'd love to get into a little bit more detail about what to look for when you're buying wax. Our listeners here in Summit County are an enthusiastic skiing community. Sure. And so we're big consumers of these products. So where do we look for, I guess, fluoride-free waxes or the plant-based waxes, things like that?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I'm not an expert on ski waxes. I'm a recreational Nordic skier only, so haven't really had a lot of personal experience. But many of the waxes actually indicate that they contain fluoro right on the label. So if you're familiar with the Swix waxes, they might say CH if they're just hydrocarbon waxes with no fluoro, or it might say LF for low fluoro or HF for high fluoro. Some of the waxes are actually, they're actually putting fluoro-free right on the label now, so that will help consumers. And I did notice that on the U.S. Ski and Snowboard website, they have a list of products there, and they're not particular, they're not endorsing any particular one, but there is information out there. And I think, you know, if you just go to the website of the ski wax manufacturer, they seem to be pretty forthcoming in terms of whether or not it's a fluoro or a fluoro-free wax. So, you know, again, I would encourage, you know, if people are doing competitions, they're going to have to find other waxes other than the fluoro waxes. And then if your listeners have been recreational skiers but have been interested in high performance and using the fluoro waxes, I would encourage them to look for alternatives.
I've got a listener texted me a question about the route of exposure to this chemical. Is it respiratory in nature, or is it more you literally have to ingest it in some form? What is the most harmful route of exposure?
That's an excellent question. And we do know that nearly everyone is exposed and has a body burden of PFAS chemicals. So even if you're not a ski wax applicator, you are being exposed. Most of our exposure, you know, to the average American is coming through contaminated drinking water or contaminated food. And again, these are ubiquitous environmental pollutants that are super persistent. And so they're just out there. And so they get into drinking water sources, groundwater, surface water. They get into our food supply. They get into, you know, fish and marine mammals and, you know, terrestrial mammals, plants. So most people are ingesting them. If you, you know, historically, when there were fewer restrictions on the way that ski wax was applied to skis, and if people weren't wearing respirators and were using irons and things like that, these chemicals can volatilize. And so there were some studies that I think really shook the ski community that showed that ski wax technicians actually were inhaling fluorinated chemical fumes.
Right.
Which is a problem. And if you used a Teflon pan, especially if it was used dry without using a lot of oil and stuff, they're at some of the fluorochemical fumes actually escape into the air. But for the most part, you know, we're actually ingesting it. We know a lot less about, say, if you have a Gore-Tex jacket, what's actually happening to the coating. We know the fluorochemicals are there, but we don't have good data on, you know, whether or not people are being exposed. One of the things I was really concerned about out at our particular ski area here in town is that there are a lot of children out there and young kids that are learning how to ski. We have a big ski club out there and it's fantastic, but you know, these kids also eat the snow and, you know, they roll around in the snow and you know, clearly our study shows that if there's a, you know, competition out there, you know, people should be steering clear of the snow on the race course. So, you know, again, that wouldn't be the most significant, sort route of exposure for the average person, but
right.
Still something to think about. Lots of people have PFAS in their drinking water around the United States. If you're interested, you can look up the website of the Environmental Working Group. Mm. They do a lot of fantastic work on tap water monitoring for chemical pollutants because the US EPA doesn't do a lot of that right now, and they don't have a binding standard for PFAS chemicals in drinking water, but lots of places have PFAS in their drinking water. My town of Waterville has low levels of three different PFAS in the drinking water.
Wow, that's fascinating and a little terrifying.
Yeah. And you say if it's in us, it's in our, let's say, in our bloodstream?
Yes. So these are fatty chemicals, and so they're detected in our blood serum, usually. And the U.S. CDC does a large-scale biomonitoring study of Americans, every year. And they, one of the things they do is to actually test things like blood and urine for all kinds of chemicals. And what they find is almost everyone has measurable levels of numerous PFAS chemicals in their blood, including children.
All right. Well, we got to wrap up. Like Nell was saying, we have a very active cross-country community,
and
skiing community.
Even more so downhill. Obviously.
And downhill. Yeah. And it's lots of competitions, et cetera. I'm thinking about the competitions and the tracks out around McPolin Barn and in that field. That's been used for years. And then that's also a area now that's used for grazing in the summer. So we should be out there maybe testing the soil and the runoff and the snow in that area for PFASs.
I think if there's been a lot of historic, skiing using fluoro waxes out in that area, you can expect that there's some degree of contamination of the soil. And so then if you're growing grasses and hay and, feeding cows or whatever, it's worth checking that out. The soil and the groundwater is where these chemicals will, persist. Once the snow melts, these chemicals have to go somewhere and they don't break down. So it's worth thinking about. The good news is that hopefully we will be introducing many, many fewer fluorochemicals into the environment in the future because of this shift in ski wax use.
All right. Where can people go to get a copy of your paper?
It is available. There's no paywall.
Oh, thank you.
And in the journal Chemosphere. So anybody can download a PDF, and I could share the link with you if you wanted to put that on your website.
We have it.
Okay.
We have that. So, we'll put it on our website. That'll be great.
Yeah, and also just looking at, ski wax websites or U.S. Ski and Snowboard, some of the governing bodies websites, the Environmental Working Group. You can get a lot of information about PFAS and about ski wax on the internet.
Perfect. Gail Carson, Assistant Professor of Environmental Studies and a Director of the Buck Lab for Climate and Environment at Colby College in Maine. Thank you so much. And thank you for going long with us. We really appreciate it, but it was a really important topic and has a lot of resonance to this community. So we thank you for taking the time to chat with us. And we may be looping back with you if we find more, see more studies about this. And if you do some
more studies. Absolutely. I'd be happy to talk more about this. And thank you so much for having me on your show.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of This Green Earth.
And if you did, we hope you'll take a minute to rate us, share us, and leave a comment.
You can email us your thoughts and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Join us next week on This Green Earth.